Well, it's a pleasure to be back in Toronto at the Fields Institute. I want to thank the organizing committee for giving me a chance to visit and to lecture. And I want to certainly thank the Fields Institute for hospitality and a wonderful working environment. Those of you who are just arriving will soon discover how good it is to be here and not doing your committee work back at home. Okay, so I want to talk about waterways. And let's see. I don't know if I got them all or not, but there's a bunch of my collaborators, and a lot of the work is actually done by them. And I usually don't manage to mention them in the middle of the lecture, so you have to look at them now. Remember, they've done most of the work. All right. So I want to start with three-dimensional situation. So here's the situation I have in mind is a flat, featureless bottom that's infinite in all directions, well, two directions, and I have water over that. So there's the bottom, but it's three-dimensional. I see I'm not very good at drawing, so don't expect much. And there's the free surface. I'm imagining a situation where some disturbance has been made, and I don't ask where it came from. The disturbance is there. Now, later in the lecture, if I get to it, I'll talk about how you might generate waves. But right now, we're not talking about that. We're just talking about some disturbance, and I'd like to know what happens. Okay, and we all know that this is an 18th century problem if you ignore viscosity. Euler wrote down a set of equations for that situation. Okay, so here's I need right away some numbers, some parameters. Oh, there's some more collaborators. Okay, so the undisturbed depth is going to be H naught. I may end up dropping that naught once in a while, but I'm never going to be talking about anything but a constant depth in this lecture. So H is equal to H naught. And there's two parameters here that are going to be important in due course. Right now, they're just numbers. So A is an amplitude parameter, and I'm going to call alpha this non-dimensional number A over H naught. And I'm going to call beta H naught over lambda. Lambda is a wavelength. Now, you have to be amplitude, something that one can understand easily enough, but wavelength is a little complicated. What you're thinking of, you take the Fourier transform of your disturbance, and you look and see where the energy is, and if it's sort of more or less concentrated around a particular energy, then you'll call that a typical wavelength. So I'm assuming, right away I'm going to make some assumptions. I'm going to assume that the surface is like I drew it. It's a graph over the bottom. Okay, so if H of X and T is the depth at point X at time T, X is a two-dimensional vector, then I'm assuming that there's a single value over there. So no overturning waves are going to be allowed in this talk. All right, so I'm going to, sorry.
Or you could say that's the reason that you're a member of the Flat Earth Society.
I'm a member of the Flat Earth. Yes, exactly. Sure enough, I'm not from California. Okay, so here are the Euler equations. So this is this is one way of writing the Euler equations. Now, I'm taking advantage of the fact, I've scaled the vertical height by H naught, so the depth has now become 1, and eta is the deviation of the free surface from its rest position. So H of X and T in dimensional variables, this is H naught plus eta. And now I've rescaled by that amplitude parameter, and an alpha appears here. Okay, right now they're numbers. I haven't assumed anything about alpha and beta. Beta appears, as you see here. Okay, so you all know this. This is Laplace's equation for the velocity potential. This is no flow through the bottom, and here are the two nonlinear boundary conditions at the free surface. Okay, so this is what we teach our kids. And now I'm going to make assumptions. And the assumptions that I make go back to this guy. So that's Boussinesq. Joseph Boussinesq. In the 1870s, he wrote a sequence of papers on waterways, and I call the regime that I'm going to be talking about today the Boussinesq regime, because Boussinesq wrote it down. So S is alpha over beta squared, sorry, and that's the Stokes number, and Stokes wrote that down, actually. Stokes wrote that combination down. He understood it was important. Dimensionally, it's A lambda squared upon H cubed, and I'm going to assume that's order one, and that's a serious assumption. Now, you suppose I could, okay, so that's order one. Then what order one is something one has to determine in the field or in the laboratory. Is 10 order one? Is 100 order one? This is something one doesn't know until you do some work. Okay, now I'm going to make a very convenient presumption. I'm going to assume S is actually equal to 1. And the reason I do that is that I don't want S's to show up in all my formulas. Otherwise, S, the number S, it's a non-dimension, it's just a number, would show up everywhere. So when I assume S is equal to 1, then I've got these two parameters, alpha and beta squared, and they're actually equal, and I'm going to call them all epsilon. Okay, so it's just, there's only one parameter. Really, there's two parameters. S is another parameter, and you can ask, you know, over what range of S's does this all work? And okay, I won't deal with that much today. Okay, so this is what folks do. This is standard. You're trying to derive some sort of model. You take the velocity potential, and you expand it in a formal Taylor expansion in the vertical coordinate. That is the vertical coordinate. Okay. And you demand that Laplace's equation hold and the no flow condition through the bottom, and that thing collapses to this formula, where phi naught is the velocity potential at the bottom. Okay, it's the velocity potential evaluated at z equals zero, and then you just get this is formal, this is completely formal, right? There's no. Okay, then you still have the two boundary conditions to satisfy. If you put that form of the velocity potential, this expansion, this formal expansion, in, and then you cut off terms. Every time you see an epsilon squared or higher, you just drop it. Then you'll get one of the standard versions of a Boussinesq type equation. Okay, so this is three-dimensional, but this is what Boussinesq did. He would recognize what we're doing right now. Okay, so there's a Boussinesq equation. That's three equations, by the way. It's not two, right? The variable v is the horizontal velocity field, and the way I've got it worked out here, v is the velocity field at the free surface. Okay, so I'm skipping some steps, but you'll forgive me. All right, now it's actually the velocity at the free surface is not a very convenient variable, nor is the velocity at the bottom a convenient variable. The reason why the velocity at the free surface is not a convenient variable is very hard to measure because the surface is moving around. The velocity at the bottom is an inconvenient variable because, in fact, there's a viscous boundary layer there, and the velocity field that you get there is nothing like the velocity field in the bulk of the fluid. So, in fact, if you're sort of practically minded, you won't like that variable. And so a standard thing to do is to change variables. So let's change to the velocity field at the height theta. Theta is just a number between 0 and 1. So that this is an approximate formula. This is, remember, I have the velocity potential, so I can figure out the velocity anywhere I want, at least to the order I'm working. And there's the velocity, v theta is the velocity at height theta. And there's the relationship between v theta and v you see right there. Okay, if you stick that into that equation, in other words, every time I see a v, I stick in a v theta, then I get another equation. Remember, I'm still dropping epsilon squareds. Anytime I see epsilon squared, I just drop it. So there's a sort of a beefed up version of Boussinesq equation. It's got one parameter in it now, the theta. So there's a one parameter family of Boussinesq equations there. Okay. Remember, that's three equations. Okay, you can do more. You needn't stop there. You can use the lowest order relationships. So these are the terms with no epsilons in them. Right. And so it's a wave equation. Right. That's the wave equation. That relationship can be used. You can't alter it. You can't do anything with the wave equation. But you can use it in the terms with order epsilon in front of them because there's an epsilon there. And so the error you're making is epsilon squared. And remember, I get to ignore all epsilon squares. Okay. So here's a yet more complicated class of Boussinesq equations, which now has three parameters, not one. It's theta. That's, we know what that means. That's the height. That just tells you which velocity variable you're using. And then I've got a modeling parameter, mu. I've just taken a linear combination of a term, a convex combination of a term. But by the way, mu need not be between 0 and 1. It's just a real number. And there's lambda here, another modeling parameter. So you get a three-parameter family of Boussinesq equations. Okay. Now that looks pretty complicated, but you can make it look simpler by just collapsing those coefficients. And so now you have this system that has four parameters, A, B, C, and D. It's not really four parameters because if you add A, B, C, and D together, you get a third. And all that is a reflection of the fact that you have to model the linearized dispersion relation at order k squared. You have to get that coefficient right. So this is a three-parameter family. It looks like four parameters. Okay, now I'm going to call this class of equations script S, I think. Maybe I'll keep doing that. Anyway, when I want to single one out, I'll call it S theta lambda mu. So theta between 0 and 1, lambda and mu are just real variables. There's a bunch of these. There's a whole bunch of these equations. All right. And by the way, just a remark that will be important in a little bit. If I just look at the linear part, and you can choose things so that this linear system, this is three equations, this linear system is symmetric. If you choose A equals C and B and D positive, you get a symmetric system which is nicely linearly posed and so forth and so on. Yeah. Yes? Yes. They're rational approximations of the full dispersion relations, what they are. They're polynomials, quadratic polynomials. So you have a quadratic polynomial in K1 and K2 divided by some other quadratic polynomial of K1 and K2. And it gets the hyperbolic tangent, the linearized relationship, right to second order. Yeah, at near zero, absolutely. Remember, so the beta is small. Remember, it's a long wave situation. I didn't say that, sorry. And by the way, you can, if you feel like it, choose these parameters so you get the next, you can get the k to the fourth coefficient correct if you feel like it. Presumably, that's better. Actually, not just presumably, one sees in laboratory experiments. That's a good idea. However, the model you get is not such a pleasant model. Just what I said. The B equals A equals C and B and D positive. Actually, B and D don't have to be positive for it to be symmetric, but that's the well-posed. That's the well-posed one. Yes. Oh, yes, indeed. Absolutely. Indeed it does. And so you'd see this guy has been his whole life ahead of me. And so I'll come. I'll come to this. I will come to this. Let me show you so those are the three-dimensional versions. I want to show you the two-dimensional versions of that because it's a little easier on your eye. So now I'm talking for a moment about motions that are uniform in the y direction. So propagation in the x direction, but there's no... So this is like in a channel. This is like a propagation in a channel generated by a flat wave maker and not at the frequency where you get crosswaves. All right, so here they are. It's the same set of equations, but now there's only x's, no d by dy's anymore. Now, that doesn't look so bad. In fact, that looks much like what you're used to when you think of Boussinesq systems. And by the way, here's this relationship. So there's a bunch of those, and maybe I'll just show you a few of them just so you can see. There's one very interesting one that I call a couple KDV system. It's not KDV, actually. This is eta t plus u triple x and ut plus eta triple x. But it feels like Korteweg de Vries. If you ignore the linear terms and make a single equation, which you can do, then you get something that feels like a KDV equation. This is a regularized one or a BBM type one. You can mix them. I don't want to go into those particularly today. Okay, now you've got all of these systems, this ABCD systems, and the question that comes to mind right away is, well, which one should I choose? Suppose I'm actually going to use these for something. Well, okay, so let me pose some criteria. We're mathematicians, we certainly want it well posed, because after all, we assumed it was well posed. And we started out by assuming that we had had wave motion that was doing nice things, no singularities were developing or anything like that. You'd like it to preserve energy, because after all, the Euler equations do. You want it to have solitary waves, because we see them. Solitary waves are important, in fact. And maybe if you got desperate, you might go out in the laboratory or the field and check and see really how does it work. So all of these things. Now, Jean-Claude So and Min Chen and I have actually analyzed all these, and we know exactly which ones are well posed and which ones are not. Unfortunately, there are lots of them that are well posed. Not all of them. So you want to get rid of them. Right now, the game would be to get rid of these things. The less you have, the less choice you get to make, and in a certain sense, that's a good thing. So, for example, not all of them preserve energy, which is a little bit of a surprise, because you'd think you're starting with something that preserves energy, and you're not doing anything that looks like you've destroyed energy or anything. Nevertheless, when you finish, they don't all preserve energy. So you throw those out, the ones that don't preserve energy, and you throw out the ones that are not well posed. Now, here's a point that's worth bearing in mind. When I say not well posed, I'm talking about this pure initial value problem on all of space. That's not, of course, the problem that a coastal engineer or a fluid mechanician that's actually going to use these things is going to be confronted with. They will have boundary conditions. And so the question of well posed that So and Chen and I settled is, by the way, when I say well posed, locally well posed. They're not all globally well posed. That seems to be sure. But locally well posed, we know which ones are locally well posed. But the question of imposition of boundary conditions is very important. And some of these that are locally well posed might very well be well posed with boundary conditions, but they require too many boundary conditions. I mean, you don't want too many boundary conditions because you have no way of determining these things. So you want as few boundary conditions as you can get by with. All right. And let's see. As usual, I prepared too much. All right, so let me just stop for a second and show you some pictures that are fun. This is the two-dimensional case now. I'm showing you here, this is time going this way, and this is one of these two-dimensional, one-dimensional, I guess. No variation in y. This is initial data, so it's a heap of water. If you think of this as water uniform across the channel, and you see its evolution in time. And by the way, the velocity is zero. So this is not an initial condition you can make. You can't make a heap of water with no velocity. If it was a conducting fluid, you might have a chance, but we're not doing MHD. So what you see is actually what you would expect if you know something about these things. You see it resolving into solitary waves. Solitary waves going this way, and actually you can't see it, but there's identical solitary waves going that way. There's a symmetry in the equation, and so symmetric initial data stays symmetric forever. So there's solitary waves going both ways, and this is not surprising. And by the way, that's one of the models, but in fact, all the well-posed ones seem to have that same property. By the way, I should mention, the well-posed ones all have solitary waves, so you didn't get any extra ones. We didn't get rid of any extra ones there. Okay, so that's actually interesting, and the reason it's interesting is the following. You don't have formulas for the solitary waves of these equations. You do for the Korteweg-de Vries equation, but you don't for these systems. There are very few formulas. A few formulas, actually, they're not even in the right range. They're not in the range we're interested in. So if you wanted to do some numerical simulations involving solitary waves, you would need to somehow generate them. Well, you could try to put in a traveling wave assumption into those equations and numerically shoot, and that's hard. That doesn't work very well. But here's a better way. Once you see that you have this property of resolution in the solitary waves, and now, by the way, I've got boundary conditions, I put in at the left-hand end here, this is a channel, I put in at the left-hand end something that's like a solitary wave. We have approximate formulas for these things. So there it goes. You see it propagating down the channel, leaving a little dispersive tail behind. propagating further. Okay, it gets to the end of the channel. I could have made a longer channel, but numerically it seems to be better. And then what you do is you cut that off, and you take that structure and you move it back down here and try again. And if, so this is kind of a filter, right? You're letting the equations filter out the dispersive stuff, and you're left with, after you do this 3, 4, 5, 6 times, depending on the amplitude, the smaller the amplitude, the more times you have to do it because it's wider, you get a tautology wave 2, 6 decimal places. That is, you get a structure that propagates with constant speed and constant shape. Okay, that's interesting. That allowed us to say something. This is Min Chen. That allows us to say something about an old issue. So here's the speed versus the amplitude of solitary waves. So this is in Russell's original work. This is something he talks about. And here's what he decided was, so C is the speed. This is in dimensional variables. G is gravity. H is the undisturbed depth, as it was before. Eta naught is the amplitude of the solitary wave. And C is the speed. And this is what Russell saw. This is experimental, and that's his fit to what he saw. It actually fits very good, very well. Now, this is the Korteweg de Vries assumption. Well, this is what Korteweg de Vries tells you. This is exact. The speed and the amplitude are directly related, and you'll recognize that this is the first two terms in the Taylor expansion of that around zero. Okay, and by the way, people have for the full Euler equations, folks have made formal expansions. There's no hint of a theorem behind any of what I'm writing here. Formal expansions of the solitary wave speed versus amplitude, and this is the third order one. It's been taken out to ninth order, and goodness knows why. I didn't say that. It was there to, that's right, exactly. So now, for the Boussinesq equations, we don't have formulas, so I can't write something like that. But I can generate them in the way that I just told you. And here's how it looks. So this is the KdV relationship, direct relationship between amplitude and speed, linear relationship. This is this line is Scott Russell's formula, that square root. And the little circles are the relationship that we found between solitary waves of these Boussinesq systems that we just generated. Okay, so it's interesting. It seems like these Boussinesq systems, at least as far as solitary waves are concerned, might be a better model than, say, Korteweg de Vries level description. All right, yes. Sure. Absolutely. Yes, so I one of my collaborators at Purdue is busy trying this. It's not so easy. Remember, this the track. Okay, well, we have plenty of time to talk, so we'll talk about this. Now, I have to tell you something. I have to confess something. So I told you a minute ago that we had a local well-posedness theory for lots of these equations. We knew exactly which ones were locally well-posed, and so one should sort of rest easy about those equations. And that what I said is not right. So let me explain something. Here's the question I want to ask. On what timescales are we expecting these models to be an accurate description? That's the question I'd like to ask. Not forever. Even if they are good descriptions over some timescale, they will not be a good description forever. Now remember, the variables that I've got here have no epsilons buried in the dependent variables. X, T, and eta, and U are all epsilon-free. Every epsilon you see is in front of you. This is the easiest set of variables to figure out these kinds of questions. Not always the easiest set of variables to work with, but for this kind of question, it's the easiest. Now, let's go back to a simpler situation. Suppose we consider, say, Korteweg de Vries. Okay, so in my variables, that looks like that equation. This is in laboratory coordinates. And by the way, the zero here is order epsilon squared. It's not zero. So what time scale do we expect this to be a good model? And the answer you can figure out basically by just solving that equation. This is meant to be a model for what nonlinearity and dispersion does. So suppose I take the initial value problem for that, and I try to solve it. And I want to compare it to that equation. Okay, well, we can solve both of those. The solution, if the initial data is, say, f, then the solution is eta of x and t is f of x minus t plus epsilon t. And the solution of that one is just f of x minus t. So the difference is right here. No surprise. And so remember, eta is order 1. And so the difference between eta and v will be small when t is of order 1. And when t gets to be of order 1 over epsilon, it's no longer small. Right? An order 1 contribution could be made. And then when it gets to be 1 on epsilon squared, these terms out here that I've ignored could make an order 1 contribution. So now you understand in a simple-minded way the crucial time scales. Again, these are in... That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, yeah, this discussion is very rough, and there are theorems behind it, but what I'm saying right now is very, very rough indeed. So the time scale, the time scale of order 1, so t of order 1, that's the time scale when you didn't bother with these two terms. That's hydraulics, by the way. That's what we teach engineers. Freshman engineers learn that that's what waterways do. They move at speed gh. G is gravity, H is the depth. So that time scale, you might as well use the wave equation. There's no advantage particularly to using. Now the time scale 1 over epsilon, that's the Boussinesq or KdV time scale. And then 1 over epsilon squared, that's the time scale on which you better, one has to check. And again, there are constants that are involved here. There's a big difference between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the minus 3. So exactly how long these things work is something you have to go out and check in a laboratory. But on this time scale, the model should be suspect. You should either take a higher order model or do something else to make corrections. Okay, so this you need to understand. And now let me confess, that local existence theory that I told you about for these Boussinesq systems doesn't go out, for most of them, it doesn't go out to the time scale 1 over epsilon. This is not good, because we want it at least to go out to that time scale. And I have to say, we were puzzled why we couldn't do better. In one or two cases, you can do better, but in general, we couldn't do better. So the problem was, not the nonlinear term, not the dispersive term. The problem was the nonlinear term. Remember, I didn't do anything to the nonlinear term. I just took what Euler gave me. And if you look at that system of three equations, and you forget about the dispersive terms, you've got a hyperbolic system. It's not symmetric. It's a non-symmetric hyperbolic system, and that's the problem. I mean, lying underneath all of our machinations, the trouble was that the hyperbolic system was not symmetric, and that's why we couldn't make better progress. Yeah, that's right, exactly. It's not symmetric. And so in desperation, so this is work with Thierry Collin and David Lann, and by the way, you're going to hear David tomorrow on much more interesting work. We made a nonlinear change of variables. So V, remember, V is V theta. Okay, I've dropped the theta. V twiddle is just what you get by that change of variables. Now, that doesn't look like such a bad change of variables. It looks invertible because eta, remember, is supposed to be order 1, and I've got an epsilon in there. So that 1 plus epsilon eta looks like you can divide by it. So you can go back and forth. Now, when you do that, when you make this change of variables, you get an even more complicated. You might really think I'm not making progress here at all. Even more complicated system of equations, right? Which bristles. But the nice thing about it is that the non-dispersive part of it, the part where I forget about the A, B, C, and D, that's a symmetric hyperbolic system. That's the crucial point. It's hard to overestimate how powerful it is to have that system symmetric. It really does make your mathematical life a lot easier. So let's see. I've got another slide which makes it look a little simpler. So there's one of those symmetric systems. there. And now if you choose A, B, C, and D right, the whole thing is symmetric. Okay, that is a powerful thing. That's the key to the theorem that I'm going to tell you. Okay, so here's a theorem coming, or I'm coming to a theorem. So this is a comparison result. So I want to remember I've done all these formal things. I made these Taylor expansions, which weren't really Taylor expansions, and I dropped terms, and goodness knows what was correct. So here's what you'd like to do. You want to start with initial amplitude and velocity. So somebody tells you, again, this is not the practically important problem. This is not the problem that you're interested in. The problem you're interested in is a problem where something generates the waves, but let's at least understand this. So you start with initial amplitude and velocity. You change variables. So I'll have a notation for this in a minute. Change variables to the symmetric Boussinesq system. That involves changes of variables. There's a velocity, particular velocity choice to be made, and so forth. And you solve that. And that one, by the way, if it's a symmetric one, I can solve it on this long time scale. So I obtain something v-twiddle and eta-twiddle. And then I want to compare these two, and I'm going to compare them in a Sobolev class HS. And S is pretty big enough. So that's not a surprise, by the way. If you look at the original work of Walter Craig, comparing KdV and Euler, you need some smoothness. Even formally, one can see that one needs some smoothness to make these comparisons. Okay, so here, the differences between the amplitude parameter and the velocity parameter, measured in this way, should be bounded by some constant, a constant we have no control of directly, and then this term epsilon squared t. Now, why is that? Why is that the term that you expect and want to get? The reason why you want epsilon squared t is that on this time scale, on the Boussinesq time scale, 1 over epsilon, this term is still size epsilon. And size, remember, eta and eta twiddle are order 1. So if their difference is order epsilon, that's the junk order for this approximation. Now, if I went to a higher approximation, of course, I would want an epsilon cubed t, say, or something like that. But I'm not at a higher order of approximation. I'm just at this elementary order. So this is what I'd like to have true. Right? That's what one is hoping for. Okay, and indeed there is a theorem like that. So here's a real live theorem. So I suppose that I'm starting out in a Sobolev class. And this is for 2 or 3 dimensions, either. And actually, in 3 dimensions, we need to assume that the curl is 0. We don't need to assume that in 2 dimensions. That's just the way it is. Sorry? Yeah. And now here's an assumption. Okay, and this is an assumption. This is not an assertion. It's not an assertion of the hypothesis. We assume we have a solution of Euler on this long time scale. We assume it's a nice solution. Now, in 2 dimensions, that's a theorem. In 3 dimensions, David has a local existence theorem, but unless he's in the last few weeks done something better, we don't have it on the long time scale. Anyway, never mind. I'm going to assume it. This is just something I'm going to assume about solutions of Euler. I'm going to assume they exist at least on this time scale. Or if you like, I'm only talking about motions for which that is true. Okay, and then here's the theorem. So there's a solution. Sigma means the symmetric system. I don't know why I introduced that, but anyway, there it is. There's a solution of the symmetric system. Everything in sight is depending on epsilon, right? And epsilon runs between 0 and 1, say. There's a solution of this symmetric system such that if you pull it back, so t is the mapping from Euler to the symmetric system, so you have to pull the variables back before you make the comparison, otherwise you're not comparing the same things. And that pullback, I'm going to call V epsilon twiddle and eta epsilon twiddle, that pullback compared to the Euler variables that I have assumed exist satisfies this estimate, exactly this epsilon squared t estimate, just what you want. Okay, so that's nice. That tells you that this symmetric system approximates Euler as well as you could formally expect it to. One particularly amusing thing about the way we do this is that we know what the term, I've got norms here, but we actually have an expansion which involves knowing what the term looks like that's got the epsilon squared t in it. And you can see that in general, it's not zero. So this is sharp. I mean, maybe it could be zero. It's hard to imagine it could be zero, but in any case, most of the time, it's not zero, and so that you're not going to improve that at this order of approximation for general initial data. Okay, now, as I say, there might be some special subclass of initial data that, where it would be better. All right, I'm naughty as always. I prepare 3 hours of lectures, and I think I'm going to give it in 45 minutes. I'll put it all on the web. Okay, I'm going to say two more things very quickly. One of them is the following. So this is just a little cartoon of how we derive these equations. You saw me doing it, sort of. Well, you saw me sketching it. You start with Euler, and now I'm two-dimensional. I'm not three-dimensional. Two-dimensional Euler, you go to the Boussinesq systems, one of those that I showed you. And then if you make a one-way assumption, you get to Korteweg de Vries. Right. Okay. That's the scheme. And now, the question I want to focus on now is, so we've been talking about the relationship between Euler and Boussinesq. Now I'd like to understand the relationship between Boussinesq and KdV. Okay. And by the way, at the end of that, if one understands that in a sort of a long-winded way, one can reproduce Walter's old result of that comparison of Euler to KdV just by going in two steps. Okay. I wouldn't have recommended this to Walter when he did it. Wasn't necessarily the right way to do it. I think what he did was better. Okay, so if you keep track of things, you just have to believe me, the one-way regime involves a relationship between eta and the velocity. That's the way you impose unidirectionality. It has to be a relationship between these two. At the wave equation level, it's just u equals eta. That's at the order zero, no epsilons. There should be an epsilon here. At the Korteweg de Vries level, this is the relationship for the variables that I've got for one of these equations. Okay. So here's a comparison result in that format. So actually, I write it for BBM, but the BBM and KdV are the same for this. There's theorems that tell us they're the same, so it doesn't matter which one you write it for. So suppose I start with initial data, which is going to be this unidirectional initial data, and I look at solving for eta or solving in one of these Boussinesq systems. There's one of them. And I ask, how do they compare? Okay, so let Q be the solution of the initial value problem. So I'm thinking now of Q as the amplitude. Q, you gave me the amplitude everywhere. Of course, you didn't do any such thing, but suppose you did. So Q is the amplitude, and it solves this Korteweg de Vries type equation. And then I'm going to solve the Boussinesq system with the same amplitude and a velocity that's determined. I got a sign wrong as well last time. This is the right relationship. Velocity that's determined by the amplitude. Okay, so both of these have solutions, and they have solutions on the right time scale. And the theorem looks like this. It's exactly the theorem you want. The difference between Q and eta is epsilon squared T. There's a constant there, of course. And the difference between U and this combination, which is supposed to be the velocity, is also epsilon squared T. All right? So this tells you, this is a pleasant result, because it tells you that all this formal stuff that you've been doing is okay. And by the way, there's a corollary of the bigger result that I didn't mention. So I told you there were well-posed and not well-posed Boussinesq systems. Suppose you take one of the not well posed ones, there are a bunch of them. Yes, sorry. No, that's a theorem. For that particular one, it's a theorem on the long time scale. I chose one where I had control. But what I'm about to say is relevant to your question. Suppose that you take an ill posed Boussinesq system. You just pick one randomly, and you pick poorly. Well, so you don't have solutions in general. But suppose somebody, one of the 41 gods comes down and whispers in your ear, here's a solution. You got it from somewhere, not from your theories. You just got it handed to you. It will approximate Euler in the same way. Even though the problem is ill-posed, if you happen to have a solution, of the right smoothness and so forth, then it will approximate Euler. And this comes out of this technique. We're basically comparing. We're basically referring everything back to solutions of Euler. So I need two things. I need Euler to have a solution on the right time scale, and I need you to give me a solution of one of these models, any of them, even the poorly posed ones, and it will approximate Euler. So that really does tell us that what we've been doing all these years, decades, centuries, is okay. These things will approximate Euler. And now there's this just the sort of mopping up operation for the mathematicians to do to figure out which ones are well posed for with boundary conditions and things like that. This may keep us busy a long time. And I'll finish now. Let me show you a slide of that comparison result. So the one that I just showed you, two-way versus one-way. Here's initial data. That's actually a solitary wave solution of the of this equation. And I put it into Boussinesq with the velocity field that I showed you a moment ago. And here you see the comparison. This is after quite a long time. So the Boussinesq spews out a small dispersive tail, but they're really quite close. And that's not surprising. That's the way it ought to be. But even more surprising, this I have to say I was surprised about. If instead of taking the initial value problem, you take the boundary value problem, like when I was generating those solitary waves. So this is a wave maker situation. Numerically, I have a channel and I have a wave maker at one end, and I'm generating waves. Okay, so those are one-way waves, by the way. That's the simple way to produce waves that go into one direction is to have a channel and generate them at one end. So I ask myself, okay, I can use Korteweg de Vries or I can use a Boussinesq system. And let's just check and see how that comparison is. I have no theorem for this, but there's a comparison. Now that's you almost can't see that there are two traces there. One of the line is the trace of the single equation, and you can just make out the dotted line. That's the trace for Boussinesq. Well, you might say to yourself, it's BBM, but yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. You might say to yourself, that's a pretty linear wave. It's not very nonlinear. Okay, you're right, but that one's nonlinear. Right. Remember, that's a spatial trace there. I'm showing you two spatial traces at a given time. Now, see, this I don't understand. I'm comparing this unidirectional thing with a pair of equations, and I'm using this I'm using in the velocity that I get out of that relationship I showed you a moment ago. But nevertheless, this is not just close, it's spot on. I don't understand this. I have not yet understood this. Okay, I'm probably over by a long way, and I apologize, and I thank you for your attention. Oh, could I show a video? It'll take... Oh, fine. Okay, great. I didn't get to this part of the talk, but the video is fun anyway. Probably I have to let it warm up, don't I? So what I'm going to show you is stuff that was done. A couple of experiments that were done by Diane Henderson and Bob Pierce in the Fluid Mechanics Laboratory at Penn State. And some of you have seen this picture before. It's good fun. Oh. Ha, there it is. Okay, so this is the not very wide channel we've got. There's a wider one there now. That's just a solitary wave, just so that if you've never ever seen one, that's what Scott Russell saw when he got so excited. Okay, now that's not what I'm interested in. What I want to show you next is easy to generate solitary waves. Actually, very easy to generate solitary waves. I could teach any of you in 10 minutes how to generate solitary. Now what I've got is a solitary wave coming from both directions. So we've got wave makers at both ends. We're generating a solitary. Y'all watch carefully. We've got wave makers at both ends, and we've got a pair of solitary waves. We know where they're going to interact because we know what their speed is. So So you're about to see a pair of, so this is not a KdV situation, this is a Boussinesq situation, pair of waves going through each other like that. Right, okay, so there it was, very, very fast. You see how fast that was. The time scale for it was very short indeed. And now here, it's the same thing, but I'm showing it to you one frame at a time, so you get an idea. So notice that this, the amplitude of these two waves is about a little over 2. So if you thought this was, for example, the time scale might say to you it was a linear interaction, but yeah, see, it's that plainly at this level. So this is Stokes' number, like 15 or something of that sort. At this level, these waves are interacting nonlinearly, even though they interact you saw how fast that interaction was. It was really very, very fast. Okay, so this would have been. You're seeing. Okay, never mind. There's essentially no. They did not measure it. We did numerical simulations of this, which showed exactly what you see. The phase shift is microscopic. There is some dispersive scatter. It's not. These are not solitons. No, I mean, they're not in the Boussinesq model, but. The phase shift is microscopic. I mean, it's not even completely clear there is a phase shift. It's so small. That's another thing I don't understand. Well, maybe I do. I mean, maybe one. Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Nick.
So I think we have time for a couple questions. When you have the long time comparison,